The debate continues on the ethics of donating organs after cardiac death. How do we make sure patients do not suffer or that their dying is prolonged? When is someone truly dead, meaning that their organs can be used for transplant? Joining us today on the Bioethics Channel to talk about it is Dr. David Magnus, the director of the Stanford Center for Biomedical Ethics. Dr. Magnus, we have a thorny issue here, donation after cardiac death. It seems like it's a balancing act between the needs of a dying patient and his or her family and the needs of a patient and his or her family needing an organ. Would it be fair to say that?
I think that it's easy to frame it that way and for people to think of it that way, but I think actually that's not the right way to think about it. I think for donation after cardiac death, unlike brain dead patients, these are still living patients, and so I think it should be absolutely understood that their needs and interests come first. There's no question that the shortage of organs and the need for more organs is certainly part of what motivates looking at donation after cardiac death. But I actually think that it's not a sufficient motivation. I think the primary reason to do donation after cardiac death is actually to respect the wishes of the dying patient, and I don't think it should in any way be anything that is contrary to the interests of the patient who's the donor. And I think if it's done properly, donation after cardiac death can in principle always be done in such a way that it actually maximizes the patient's interest by allowing a dying process that's dignified and allows their wishes for what they want to be respected and allows the family to find some solace in what is usually a tragic situation.
Keeping with that theme a little bit of the balancing act, the doctor involved has a balancing act that he or she needs to pull off between the duty to the living patient and the duty to the patient who needs the organ. And so they have their balancing act to pull off.
So again, I think what we want to do is try and avoid those kinds of conflicts of interest. So I think it's certainly a worry when you've got situations either because you're in an area where there's only one transplant center, or this is especially a big issue with children's hospitals where it's more common for one major center to be the transplant center, so the hospital that's typically taking care of the patients is also taking care of the recipients. I think as much as possible we want to separate those roles. I don't think it's appropriate for individual physicians to be weighing those sorts of things. With donation after cardiac death, unlike brain death, the patient's primary obligation has to be understood as belonging to the living patient who's the donor. That should really be their focus. And donation is a way of respecting that and of respecting the patient's wishes, but absolutely what comes first, second, and last should be the care of the patient, the living patient who you're taking care of, not somebody who's going to be a recipient. It turns out that respecting patients' and families' wishes does, in fact, often wind up in doing things like procurement of organs and DCD that help other people, but that's a great benefit. But to me, that's not the reason to do that, and you, because of that, really want to separate those roles. I think the physicians who are taking care of recipients should not be the ones taking care of the patients who are the donors.
Then you have the issue. You said that this is a living patient, and then one of the first things you do or have to do is decide to withdraw life-sustaining treatment, and that's a difficult thing too.
Absolutely. And again, it's really important that that be prior to any considerations of organ donation. But in a way, that's the best way, I think, to think about donation after cardiac death. As much as possible, we want to think of this the way we would think about any other withdrawal of life support that we do all the time. I deal with this in our ICU all the time. So we want to think of this just like it's just like any other case. You've got a patient with a very grave prognosis whose likely outcome in terms of quality of life is such that it's not a life that they would find acceptable. You work with families around those issues and around the prognosis and try and ascertain as best you can what the patient's values are. And if it becomes clear that the patient's values are incompatible with the outcomes in terms of prognosis, families will often decide that it's appropriate to discontinue life-sustaining treatments, and then you want to make sure that procurement that process by which you withdraw life-sustaining treatments is humane and pain-free, and you want to do that whether it's a withdrawal that takes place in the ICU, like the vast majority of our withdrawals, or those exceptional circumstances of a donation after cardiac death. It should be as much as possible the exact same process. The only difference really should be is that at the end of the process, if everything's been followed correctly, after the patient has passed away, organs can be procured. But it should be the death, the dying process, as much as possible. We want to be like any other dying process.
A critical question, and one that's come under much debate and discussion lately, is how long do you wait when someone is declared dead? And there have been issues where 3 minutes, even 75 seconds in some cases, has been the amount of time elapsed. And I think people cringed at the idea of 3 minutes or especially 75 seconds.
Yeah, and I think that's one of the big challenges, is drawing that line. So in principle, we all agree about how this process ought to go, but figuring out the point and at which we draw the line of deciding that you're dead by cardiac death is actually really, really important. And the lack of agreement, the lack of standards, the lack of agreed-upon protocols, I think, has been a huge problem plaguing donation after cardiac death. The Institute of Medicine recommends 5 minutes. For adults, there's no data that shows that spontaneous resuscitation happens without attempts at artificial resuscitation after about a little over a minute. And so 5 minutes seems like a prudent approach. 92% of OPOs in the U.S. have that as their standard, and that seems to be emerging as the new standard, is 5 minutes, though there is some variation between 2 minutes and 5 minutes. And I think there's evidence, at least for adults, that anything between 2 and 5 minutes is not unreasonable. 75 seconds absolutely crosses a boundary, and declaring a patient dead, especially an infant, because there's not as good evidence about spontaneous resuscitation, declaring a patient to have irreversible cessation of function after 75 seconds, I think, is really, really tricky.
Well, it seemed like that 5 minute declaration was something that was rather arbitrary at first, right?
It was arbitrary at first, but there's been more and more agreement around it. I do think I think anything between 2 and 5 minutes potentially could be justified. The fact that socially 5 minutes is starting to emerge as a consensus, the evidence seems to suggest that a 2 minute boundary is, at least for adults, is not unreasonable, but I think 5 minutes is the emerging standard. It's a prudent, conservative approach, and so I think it's best, and I'm hoping that we will go from 92% to 100% of the OPOs eventually adopting the IOM recommended standards. But the attacks on this standard and the people who don't believe that these patients are dead even at 5 minutes argue that because you could still, in principle, resuscitate the patients, how can you say that cessation of life support that circulation is irreversibly discontinued? How could it be irreversible if we could, in fact, reverse it? And so there are some people who say that the standard ought to be not when their heart stops and can't auto-resuscitate, but the point at which you can't resuscitate them if you attempt to. So they would advocate waiting, 20 minutes, half an hour, 40 minutes, which would make donation after cardiac death impossible. And I think that's it's a tricky issue. What are we looking for when we declare death? Now, my view is what we ought to be doing is thinking about this, as I said, as much like we would any other ICU case. And the fact is, intentions matter. If you've got a patient who's in the ICU who's full code and their heart stops, we will attempt to resuscitate them, and we won't declare them dead until half an hour, 40 minutes after attempts have shown to be futile or have failed. In cases where a patient is a no-code, they do not attempt to resuscitate or allow natural death, in those kinds of cases, when a patient's heart stops, we declare them dead basically as soon as we can get a physician into the room to declare them dead, and we can do it often very, very quickly. Certainly within 5 minutes is often possible in those circumstances. And since, by definition, in donation after cardiac death patients, these are all do not attempt resuscitation patients, we should really see it as similar. If they're dead after 5 minutes in the ICU, they should be dead after 5 minutes in the OR as well.
So with what we know now, how should hospitals and organ procurement organizations address this in terms of a policy?
Well, I think it's very complex, and I think they need to address a number of elements in the procurement process. I think they need to have very clear distinction between the roles so that there's no conflicts of interest. I think they need to address those conflicts of interest, so I think that it's important that there be a mandatory ethics consult in all DCD cases. I think the attending has to be mindful and actually explicitly say that I think it's appropriate to go forward with donation after cardiac death as another protection. I think you have to have very clear protocols to draw a wedge between the roles role of the team taking care of the patient and the team that's responsible for procurement of the organs. One group is responsible for taking care of the patient up until death and the declaration of death. The other team is only supposed to come in after the patient has passed away for procuring of the organs, and that's really, I think, critical. And I think all of these roles have to be well-defined, and you need to have a very robust informed consent process so that the families understand exactly what's being done and all the pitfalls, including the fact that very typically in DCD, there's at least some preservative measures that are taken, which in my opinion should be very minimal, prior to the patient's passing away. And that is something where that's something for the benefit of the organs and not for the benefit of the patient.
Some hospitals will be able to do this rather easily. Somebody like Stanford with a lot of resources would be able to. What about hospitals in other parts of the country who may not have those kinds of resources?
Well, I think it's tough, but I think if a hospital really doesn't have the resources to do DCD in an appropriate fashion, and we saw this, I think, in the situation that took place in San Luis Obispo, where Ruben Navarro, who is probably a very poor candidate for DCD. In DCD, you have to pass away within a fairly short period of time after withdrawal of the ventilator. It's pretty clear looking at it in hindsight, but the clinical evidence was there that he was very unlikely to pass away within a reasonable period of time. He should have been a very poor candidate. Moreover, the hospital didn't know what it was doing. Nobody had any experience with DCD. They didn't have a clear protocol, and so they treated the patient as if he was brain dead and essentially abandoned him into the OR, leading to all kinds of problems and ultimately a criminal prosecution. If you don't have the resources to really do this, if you don't know what you're doing and you can't do this well and successfully, then you shouldn't do donation after cardiac death.
Will we ever be perfect about this?
Of course not. So we're probably not perfect. Like, I know we're not perfect about brain death. There are times when families misunderstand. I've had situations where I've talked to people who clearly misunderstood the nature of the organ procurement process. So clearly something went wrong at least in the communication process. So nothing is perfect. But what you want to do is set up policies and protocols, have them clearly lay out what roles different individuals are to play, have a set of procedures in place to make sure that there are people thinking about things as much as possible in thoughtful, reflective ways. Make sure that you've got enough checks in the system, including oversight and review, so that when there are problems, you learn from them so that they don't happen again. And I think if you do all of those things and everybody plays their part, the OPO, the organ procurement organization, the teams taking care of the patient, the ethics committees, which I recommend being involved in all of these kinds of cases, if everybody does their job, then I think it increases dramatically the chances that you're going to actually have a good outcome and be able to successfully do donation after cardiac death in a way that helps meet what the patient's interests are, who want to be donors, but does so in a way that's safe and effective for them.
Dr. David Magnus is director of the Stanford Center for Biomedical Ethics. I'm Laurel LeBou. Thanks for listening to the Bioethics Channel.